Welcome to the African American Hour. I'm Byron Buckner, bringing you an hour of news, history, commentary, and information about the African American community. This week I'll have readings from the websites MSN.com and RollingOut.com. I'll have a reading from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution newspaper. I'll have one from the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette newspaper, Vogue magazine. I'll wrap up with a book review from Yale University, and I'm starting with this. Pope Leo XIV's Creole Heritage highlights complex history of racism in the church in America. This was written by Deepa Bharath and Jack Brooke, and was published May 9, 2025 at the Associated Press's AP.com website. The new pope's French-sounding last name, Prevost, intrigued Jari Onora, a New Orleans genealogist who began digging in the archives and discovered the new pope had deep roots in the Big Easy. All four of Pope Leo XIV's maternal great-grandparents were free people of color in Louisiana based on 19th-century census records, Onora found. As part of the melting pot of French, Spanish, African and Native American cultures in Louisiana, the Pope's maternal ancestors would be considered Creole. It was special for me because I share that heritage and so do many of my friends who are Catholic here in New Orleans, said Onora, a historian at the Historic New Orleans Collection, a museum in the French Quarter. Onora and others in the Black and Creole Catholic community say the election of Leo, a Chicago native who spent over two decades in Peru, including 8 years as a bishop, is just what the Catholic Church needs to unify the global church and elevate the profile of Black Catholics whose history and contributions have long been overlooked. Leo, who has not spoken openly about his roots, may also have an ancestral connection to Haiti. His grandfather, Joseph Norval Martinez, may have been born there, though historical records are conflicting, Onora said. However, Martinez's parents, the Pope's great-grandparents, were living in Louisiana since at least the 1850s, he said. Andrew Jolivet, a professor of sociology and Afro-Indigenous studies at the University of California, Santa Barbara, did his own digging and found the Pope's ancestry reflected the unique cultural tapestry of southern Louisiana. The Pope's Creole roots draw attention to the complex, nuanced identities Creoles hold, he said. There is Cuban ancestry on his maternal side. So there are a number of firsts here, and it's a matter of pride for Creoles, said Jolivet, whose family is Creole from Louisiana. So I also view him as a Latino pope because the influence of Latino heritage cannot be ignored in the conversation about Creoles. Most Creoles are Catholic, and historically it was their faith that kept families together as they migrated to larger cities like Chicago, Jolivet said. The former Cardinal Robert Prevost's maternal grandparents, identified as mulatto and black in historical records, were married in New Orleans in 1887 and lived in the city's historically Creole Seventh Ward. In the coming years, the Jim Crow regime of racial segregation rolled back post-Civil War reforms, and just about every aspect of their lives was circumscribed by race, extending even to the church, Onora said. The next part of the article is titled, An American Story of Migration. The Pope's grandparents migrated to Chicago around 1910 like many other African-American families leaving the racial oppression of the Deep South, and passed for white, Onora said. The Pope's mother, Mildred Agnes Martinez, who was born in Chicago, is identified as white on her 1912 birth certificate, Onora said. You can understand, people may have intentionally sought to obfuscate their heritage, he said. Always, life has been precious for people of color in the South, New Orleans included. The Pope's grandparents' old home in New Orleans was later destroyed, along with hundreds of others, to build a highway overpass that eviscerated a stretch of the largely black neighborhood in the 1960s, Onora said. A former New Orleans mayor, Mark Morial, called the Pope's family history an American story of how people escape American racism and American bigotry. As a Catholic with Creole heritage who grew up near the neighborhood where the Pope's grandparents lived, Morial said he has contradictory feelings. While he's proud of the Pope's connection to the city, Morial said the new pontiff's maternal family's shifting racial identity highlights the idea that in America people had to escape their authenticity to be able to survive. The next part of the article is titled, African American Influence on Catholicism. The Reverend Ajani Gibson, who heads the predominantly black congregation at St. Peter Claver Church in New Orleans, said he sees the Pope's roots as a reaffirmation of African American influence on Catholicism in his city. I think a lot of people take for granted that the things that people love most about New Orleans are both black and Catholic, said Gibson, referring to rich cultural contributions to Mardi Gras, New Orleans jazz tradition, and brass band parades known as second lines. He hoped the Pope's Creole heritage, emerging from the city's cultural gumbo pot, signals an inclusive outlook for the Catholic Church. I want the continued elevation of the universal nature of the Church, that the Church looks, feels, sounds like everybody, Gibson said. We all have a place and we come and bring who we are, completely and totally, as gifts to the Church. Shannon D. Williams, a history professor at the University of Dayton, said she hopes that Leo's genealogical roots and historic papacy will underscore that all roads in American Catholicism in North, South, and Central America lead back to the Church's foundational roots of the mostly unacknowledged and unreconciled history of Catholic colonialism, slavery, and segregation. There have always been two transatlantic stories of American Catholicism, one that begins with Europeans and another one that begins with Africans and African-descended people, free and enslaved, living in Europe and Africa in the 16th century, she said. Just as black history is American history, Leo's story also reminds us that black history is, and always has been, Catholic history, including in the United States. Kim R. Harris, associate professor of African American religious thought and practice at Loyola Marymount University in Los Angeles, said the Pope's genealogy got her thinking about the seven African-American Catholics on the path to sainthood who have been recognized by the National Black Catholic Congress but haven't yet been canonized. Harris highlighted Pierre Toussaint, a philanthropist born in Haiti as a slave who became a New York City entrepreneur and was declared venerable by Pope John Paul II in 1997. The excitement I have in this moment probably has to do with the hope that this Pope's election will help move this canonization process along, Harris said. While it's not known how Leo identifies himself racially, his roots bring a sense of hope to African American Catholics, she said. When I think about a person who brings so much of the history of this country in his bones, I really hope it brings to light who we are as Americans and who we are as a people of the diaspora, she said. It brings a whole new perspective and widens the vision of who we all are. Reynold Verrett, president of Xavier University of Louisiana in New Orleans, the only historically black Catholic university, said he was a little surprised about the Pope's heritage. It's a joyful connection, he said. It's an affirmation that the Catholic Church is truly universal, and that black Catholics remained faithful, regardless of a church that was human and imperfect. It also shows us that the church transcends national borders. One of the graphics that goes along with this story is a family tree that looks at the Pope's mother's family. This branch of his family tree shows his mother, his grandparents, and his great-grandparents. It starts with his mother. Mildred Agnes Martinez is listed as white on her birth certificate. The Pope's grandparents, on his mother's side of the family, were Joseph Martinez, who is of Haitian descent, and Louise Baquet, who is mulatto and black. The Pope's great-grandparents, on his mother's side of the family, were Jacques Martinez and Maria Rosa Ramos, who are described as free people of color, and also Ferdinand Baquet and Eugene Grandbois, who are described as mulatto. That was the article, Pope Leo XIV's Creole Heritage Highlights Complex History of Racism and the Church in America. It was written by Deva Bharath and Jack Brook and published May 9, 2025 at the Associated Press's AP.com website. Next is a reading from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution newspaper's 2025 Black History Month series, which marks its 10th year, and it focuses on the role of African Americans in building Atlanta, Georgia, and the overwhelming influence that African Americans have had on this nation's culture. The title of this story is Stop the Presses, Not at Savannah's Black Newspaper. This was written by Adam Van Bremer and published February 20th, 2025. The subtitle to the story is, Founded in 1875, the Tribune has shuttered twice, only to resume operations, and has been the voice for the African-American community for generations. Shirley James hears often of the historic and unprecedented challenges faced by newspaper publishers in the digital age. Her publication, the Savannah Tribune, faces the same threats as other long-running print-centric media outlets. The advertiser's exodus, the demise of classifieds, an aging readership, younger generations that see social media channels as primary news sources. For the Tribune, a weekly launched 150 years ago this summer as the Savannah Colored Tribune, the current business climate is not the worst of times. From its founding as a written information source, catering to a largely illiterate audience, most freed enslaved people had no formal schooling, the Tribune has thrived on its ability to survive. The publication has overcome censorship, distribution challenges, and ill-timed closure, a legal challenge that reached the Georgia Supreme Court, even a devastating fire. The word fortitude belongs in the publication's masthead, alongside the staff listing and contact information, joked James and Tribune Vice President Tanya Milton. We have to be optimistic about this publication's future because we are the voice of African Americans and they depend on us for the truth, James said. That was the charge that was handed to us. We have to tell our stories about what we do, what we have accomplished, and historically what we have overcome. James and her husband, Bob, are the third family to own the Savannah Tribune. Like their predecessors, they've stayed true to the publication's founding principle to give black residents a voice, particularly on race and public policy issues, no matter the consequences. The Tribune's original publisher, John DeVoe, along with his partners Lewis Toomer Sr. and Lewis Pleasant, printed their first edition in 1875 and met resistance from the earliest days. The Civil War had ended just a decade earlier, and the black community was beset by low literacy rates. Reporting and editorials were written in plain language and in direct tones so as to be easily understood. The messages so antagonized Savannah's white community that the city's printing press operators refused to produce it starting in 1878. The Tribune went out of print for 8 years before DeVoe found a new printer. 3 years later, DeVoe took a government job in Brunswick and sold the Tribune to Saul C. Johnson. The Johnson family's ownership spanned 7 decades and much of the Jim Crow era. He advocated for equality with an emphasis on education. The Tribune's stances on schoolhouse conditions and teacher resources and wages ingrained the publication in the fabric of Black Savannah, said Otis Johnson, the civil rights icon and two-term Savannah mayor. He was fearless in his critiques of the conditions we as African Americans were living under, said Otis Johnson, who cites the Tribune as one of his earliest reading materials as a boy. John DeVoe, Saul Johnson, and now Shirley and Bob James, they've been doing what they should be doing as publishers of the paper in terms of our welfare and advancement. That's why people in the black community love the Tribune so much. Saul Johnson led the Tribune until his death in 1954 at age 85, but his descendants lacked his passion for the newspaper. It shuttered in 1960, just as the civil rights movement was cresting in Savannah with a series of nonviolent protests, such as sit-ins at department store lunch counters that led to desegregation. Bob James, Shirley's husband, recognized the community's affection for the Tribune shortly after moving to Savannah in 1971 to run Carver State Bank. By then, the Tribune had become a nostalgic memory. The Carver State Bank's board of directors, many of them lifelong Savannians, spoke of the Tribune and how much the black community missed it, even as another black weekly, the Savannah Herald, was in print at the time. Shirley heard similar sentiments in her work as a counselor at Savannah State, the local historically black university. The Jameses sensed a business opportunity and resurrected the Tribune in 1973. They faced and won a challenge that made it to the Georgia Supreme Court over ownership of the publication's name and history, and have led the paper ever since, with Shirley taking on the title of publisher in 1983. The Tribune has never missed a publication deadline since its relaunch, even when an electrical fire on New Year's Eve 2005 destroyed its offices and all its equipment. Under the James's tenure, the Tribune has covered the rise of the black political class in Savannah and Chatham County. Currently, black leaders hold every jurisdiction-wide elected office in the county, from Savannah mayor to district attorney, and from Chatham Commission chairman to county coroner. The Tribune stories on the issues and candidates, and the publication's endorsements, have shaped that leadership. When Otis Johnson called on the black community to rally behind one candidate in the 2019 Savannah mayoral race in order to unseat an incumbent, he made the plea via a guest column in the Tribune, not in a televised speech, social media post, or a letter to the editor in the region's daily newspaper of record, the Savannah Morning News. The Tribune is where our community turns for information still, Johnson said. That's the Tribune's place in Savannah. Savannah Tribune readers are largely print readers, and they aren't shy about clinging so tightly that they get ink on their fingers. The publication overhauled its circulation strategy early in the digital age. They made the print edition free and distributed it through more than 200 black churches in the Savannah area. They estimate their readership at 45,000. Milton, the advertising director, leveraged that reach into wooing advertisers and now says she does more answering calls and emails than knocking on doors. The Tribune's news coverage approach under James has always been rooted in news and happenings that uplift the community, with a focus on church and social life and highlighting achievements. It steers away from crime stories and those involving violence. Yet, the Tribune doesn't shy away from controversy when it comes to writing about issues that affect the black community. James cites the bevy of voting law changes made since the 2020 presidential election, when false allegations of voter fraud led the Georgia General Assembly to alter the process around absentee ballots and in-person voting. The Tribune's news staff, led by editorial assistant Tyranny Reeves, devoted hundreds of columns to explainers and notices about deadlines and application processes. The paper still publishes sample ballots. You talk about mission, and voting is at the core, going all the way back to 1875, James said. Much of what we've been writing about in recent years is similar to what was in the Tribune all those years ago, and many times in between. We're there for the community. There are some images that go along with the story. One is the image of the Savannah Tribune newspaper from the 1950s. Some of the headlines on this particular page are "Segregation in Public Schools Outlawed by Supreme Court," "Plan in the Making for Big Memorial Day Parade," "Whites Enter Elks Oratorical Contest," 17 Opportunity Fellowships awarded, Christmas seal sales highest since 1945. Another image that goes along with this story is the front page from what is then titled the Colored Tribune of March 25th, 1876. There is one story about the African Methodist Episcopal Church, another story about a religious revival, And the final story on the front page of this edition of that newspaper is a column titled Madam Smith, Fortune Teller and Astrologist. And the last image I'm going to describe that goes along with this story is the front of the Savannah Tribune newspaper from November of 2008. And on that front page, it says, Barack Obama, 44th President of the United States. Another story headline is, Chief Justice Sears to leave Supreme Court. And there's another story titled, Savannah's 100 Celebrity Men Who Cook Kicks Off Ninth Season. That was the story, Stop the Presses? Not at Savannah's Black Newspaper. It was written by Adam von Bremer, and it was published February 20th, 2025 in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution newspaper. My next reading is from the MSN.com website. The title is, Mayor Van Johnson Named African American Mayors Association President. This was written by Chris Hummer and published April 20th, 2025. The African American Mayors Association is proud to announce that Mayor Van R. Johnson II of Savannah, Georgia, has been appointed as president of the national nonprofit organization. Mayor Johnson was officially sworn in on Friday, April 18th, at the conclusion of the AAMA's annual conference in Washington, D.C. As we continue to build on the legacy of the African American Mayors Association and advocate for the needs of over 500 mayors within our growing organization, I am delighted to welcome Mayor Van R. Johnson II as our new president, said AAMA CEO Phyllis Dickerson. Mayor Johnson's dedication to public service and his innovative approach to city leadership make him a perfect choice to lead our organization into the future. We are eager to support his vision for our member cities and communities. I also want to thank Mayor Stephen Reed for his incredible service to our cities and our organization this past year. That was the story. Mayor Van Johnson named African American Mayors Association President. It was written by Chris Hummer and published April 20th, 2025 at the MSN.com website. My next reading is from the website RollingOut.com, which focuses on issues in the Afro-American community. The title of this story is Three Trends Reshaping Black Natural Hair Movement. It was written by Vera Imogene and published April 30th, 2025. The natural hair movement has fundamentally transformed beauty standards for African-American women, creating space for the celebration of curls, coils, and kinks in all their varied expressions. This cultural shift has evolved into a thriving industry driven by black entrepreneurs who prioritize hair health, environmental sustainability, and cultural pride. From advanced protective styling techniques to eco-conscious product formulations, these innovations empower African-American women to embrace their natural textures while addressing specific needs unique to their hair types. The movement represents far more than aesthetic preferences. It embodies economic empowerment, cultural reclamation, and a redefinition of beauty standards. The next part of the article is titled, From Movement to Multi-Billion Industry. The natural hair movement, which gained significant momentum in the early 2000s, encouraged African-American women to abandon chemical relaxers and embrace their natural hair textures. What began as a cultural shift has evolved into a robust industry, with black consumers spending over $2.5 billion annually on hair care products, according to Nielsen Research. Black-owned brands have spearheaded this transformation, developing formulations specifically designed to address the unique characteristics of African-American hair. These products tackle common concerns including high porosity, moisture retention, and breakage prevention while simultaneously celebrating cultural identity through their marketing and ingredients. The current wave of innovations builds upon this foundation, blending scientific advancement, traditional knowledge, and creative problem-solving to deliver solutions that are both effective in addressing hair care challenges and empowering in their cultural approach. The next part of the article is titled, Three Transformative Trends Revolutionizing Natural Hair Care. The natural hair care landscape has seen remarkable innovation across multiple fronts, with three key trends emerging as particularly significant. Advanced protective styling techniques have revolutionized how African American women maintain hair health while expressing creativity. Knotless braids represent a significant breakthrough, gradually feeding in hair without tight knots at the scalp, reducing tension and traction alopecia risk. Crochet braiding enables faster installation of styles like faux locks by using a hook to loop pre-twisted hair through cornrows. For lock wearers, the interlocking technique offers a low-maintenance approach that creates a polished appearance lasting longer between sessions. Supporting these innovations, brands like Ali K Naturals, Miel Organics, and Talia Wajid provide specialized products formulated for protective styles. Eco-friendly hair care lines from black-owned companies set new standards for sustainability. Pattern Beauty, founded by Tracy Ellis Ross, offers biodegradable formulations in recyclable packaging, featuring ingredients like aloe vera and coconut oil. Camille Rose has gained popularity with products like their Algae Renew Deep Conditioner, emphasizing organic sourcing and minimal plastic use. The Do, created by hairstylist Maya Smith, bridges salon-quality performance with environmental responsibility through products like their sucker-free moisturizing shampoo that cleanses without stripping natural oils. Technology-driven personalization is transforming natural hair care through innovative digital tools. Myavana's Hair AI Analysis Tool scans hair to generate customized product recommendations based on individual characteristics like porosity and curl pattern. In the scalp health arena, Dr. Kerry Williams' Trichology Clinic offers specialized treatments addressing common concerns like dryness and flaking, while making expertise accessible through virtual consultations nationwide. The next section of the article is titled, Cultural Pride and Economic Empowerment. The significance of these innovations extends far beyond cosmetic improvements. They strengthen African American cultural identity by celebrating traditionally marginalized hair textures and styles. Black-owned brands like Pattern, Camille Rose, and The Do intentionally feature diverse African American models in their marketing materials and incorporate ingredients with African origins such as baobab oil and shea butter. Protective styling techniques, many of which have roots in African traditions, provide wearers with tangible connections to their heritage. The popularity of styles like Fulani braids adorned with beads illustrates how hair serves as both personal expression and cultural affirmation for many African American women. Community building represents another vital dimension of the natural hair movement. Leading brands regularly host educational workshops, pop-up shops, and social media engagement campaigns, such as Pattern's hashtag Curl Challenge, where African American women share styling techniques and product recommendations. Myavana's online platform connects users with black hairstyles, fostering supportive networks. These initiatives create affirming spaces for black women to celebrate their hair journeys while counteracting generations of Eurocentric beauty standards. The economic impact has been equally profound. The natural hair industry has created significant opportunities for African-American entrepreneurs and professionals. Black-owned brands generate employment across various sectors, from product development to marketing and distribution. Hairstylists specializing in natural hair care and protective styling have established thriving businesses, both in traditional salon settings and as independent practitioners. The marketplace success of brands like Miel Organics, which has secured prominent placement in major retailers including Ulta Beauty, demonstrates the substantial economic potential of businesses catering specifically to African American consumers. This commercial achievement represents a significant shift in the beauty industry's recognition of black buying power and preferences. The final section of the article is titled, Future Horizons for Natural Hair Innovation. The trajectory of natural hair care innovation shows no signs of slowing. Black-owned brands are exploring cutting-edge approaches, including biotechnology for developing plant-based ingredients, and experimenting with 3D-printed hair tools designed for precision styling of textured hair. Virtual reality tutorials focused on protective styling techniques are beginning to emerge, offering African-American women opportunities to practice complex braiding and twisting methods at home before attempting them independently. As consumer demand continues to grow, many brands are expanding their reach globally, introducing African-American hair care expertise to markets throughout Africa and the Caribbean. The natural hair care revolution continues to empower African-American women to embrace their textures with confidence and pride. From innovative protective styles like knotless braids to eco-conscious product lines from companies like Pattern Beauty and Camille Rose, Black-owned businesses are establishing new standards for effective, sustainable hair care. By thoughtfully integrating tradition, technology, and cultural celebration, these advancements honor African-American beauty while simultaneously building community connections and creating economic opportunities. The movement represents far more than aesthetic preferences. It embodies the reclamation of identity and the continuing evolution of beauty standards to embrace the full spectrum of human diversity. That was the article titled, Three Trends Reshaping Black Natural Hair Movement. It was written by Vera Imagine and published April 30th, 2025 at the website rollingout.com. My next reading is from the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette newspaper and was published May 4th, 2025. The title is Kidney Disease in the Black Community. This is an interview of Dr. Amit Tavar, a surgeon at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. No author is listed. Amit Tavar earned a medical degree from the University of Missouri School of Medicine in 2000, then completed a surgery residency at Indiana University School of Medicine in 2005. He went on to complete a fellowship in multi-organ transplant and hepatobiliary surgery at the University of Chicago's Pritzker School of Medicine in 2007 and practiced at the University of Cincinnati from 2007 to 2012. The surgical director of the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center's Kidney and Pancreas Transplant Program, Tavar arrived at UPMC in 2012. Question: what is kidney disease? Tavar: kidneys are a pretty vital organ within our body that actually do a lot of things. Most importantly, they clear out toxins from the body and generate urine, which allows us to do two things: excrete those toxins and also adjust the amount of fluid in our body. When we talk about renal failure, that refers to a chronic disease when both kidneys progressively decline in their kidney function to the point where they can no longer excrete or clear those toxins, and also can no longer regulate the amount of fluid in their body. So in those folks that go on to what we call renal failure, they require one of two things: dialysis, either through the belly, through peritoneal dialysis, or hemodialysis. Or a much better option long term is transplantation. Question: how's the severity of kidney disease measured? Answer: when we talk about kidney disease, we define it through a measurement called the GFR, or glomerular filtration rate. This basically measures how quickly kidneys function and remove toxins. A GFR number of 20 or less is required before you can be active on a transplant list and accrue time waiting for a kidney transplant. Question: what is the relationship between race and kidney disease? There have been several different GFR formulas, and one of the first formulas used in the past had a different variable for people who were identified as black. What that meant is that they got a different GFR based on being African American or black, and a lot of societies and researchers found more recently that this was very, very inaccurate, and it did several things. Number one, it underestimated their degree of kidney disease. So unfortunately, what happened was that many black individuals were categorized at a falsely higher GFR, and this delayed their access to transplant. To those within the transplant community and the community of medical providers dealing with end-stage renal disease, this was a significant disservice to people who were black, because it did not allow them on-time access to transplantation. Question: what is a living donation? Answer: when we talk about living donation, what that means is, if you are listed for a kidney transplant and you have the potential to either stay on the list and wait for a cadaveric organ, which can sometimes take upwards of 60 months, a much better option in our eyes and what we've done here at UPMC is really promote living donation. What that means is, if you are on the list, you can have a live donor, and that can be someone who is from your family, could be from a work group, it can be an acquaintance, it can be anyone that wants to donate a kidney. Our team would obviously screen them and do an evaluation and make sure that it's safe for them, short-term and long-term, to function with just one kidney. Question: how are African Americans seeking live donors at a disadvantage? Answer: with a live donation, they get a transplant right away, and we actually approach this as the first option for transplantation. That's one of the clear messages we want to get out. The African American community has significantly lower rates of living donations. In 2024, 17% of organs recovered for African Americans were from live donors, compared with 30% from people that were Caucasian. There's multiple factors, including financial concerns, health disparities, medical mistrust. But these are things that we're actively trying to overcome here at UPMC, and we really want our African American communities and populations to understand that living donation is by far the better option, and something we spend a lot of time making sure is safe for donors and recipients, short and long term. Question: what's being done to overcome these disparities? Answer: within UPMC, one of our largest focuses within transplantation is to actually get awareness and focus information and our resources to black Pittsburghers. A couple of things that are important to keep in mind. If you are African American, you are 4 more times likely than Caucasians to develop kidney failure, which requires dialysis. And although African Americans make up a small segment of the United States population, they account for 32% of the people that have kidney failure. So there's a significant discrepancy in the number of people that are African American that require transplantation. The big thing that happened here at UPMC started back in the first month of 2023. In 2023, there was a new movement and decree made by OPTN, which is the Organ Procurement Transplantation Network, a governmental agency. And this new policy very unequivocally put into effect that black candidates will be eligible for waiting time modifications. And what this means is, anyone that is listed for transplantation who is black on your list, we would go back through and readjust their GFR to be appropriate for their level of kidney disease. People who have been on the list that are waiting for transplantation and had time excluded because they were a falsely elevated GFR would now get that time back. This was the interview of Dr. Amit Tavar, Surgical Director of the University of Pittsburgh's Kidney and Pancreas Transplant Program, from the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette newspaper, titled Kidney Disease in the Black Community, and was published May 4, 2025. No author is listed. Next on today's African American Hour is a look at fashion. This is from Vogue magazine and is titled Black Dandyism Explained, From Its 18th Century Roots to Modern Day Expressions. This was written by Ty Gaskins and published April 29, 2025. There is something undeniably magnetic about the sharp creases of a tailored suit, the gleam of polished leather shoes, the swish of a silk pocket square. But for black dandyism, this isn't just about looking good. It's a declaration. A defiant reclaiming of a space in a world that has long sought to define and confine black identity. So, what exactly is black dandyism? At its core, it's a fashion revolution, a movement steeped in history, resistance, and pride. But its impact stretches far beyond the sartorial. It's a cultural statement, an act of protest, and above all, an enduring celebration of individuality. With the 2025 Met Gala theme, Superfine, Tailoring Black Style, focusing on the pivotal role black culture plays in shaping fashion, black dandyism is receiving the global spotlight it has long deserved. Dandyism is often described as a style, but it's more than just aesthetics. The original dandy, most famously embodied by figures like Beau Brummel in 18th century Britain, was a man whose primary purpose was to stand out by being impeccably groomed and dressed. Brummel, whose personal motto was, "Don't talk about your clothes, let your clothes do the talking," revolutionized fashion by elevating personal style into an art form. He rejected the flamboyance of past aristocratic dress, favoring understated, sharp tailoring that emphasized refinement over ostentation. For the dandy, fashion was a vehicle for both self-expression and a subtle form of rebellion against societal norms. And that rebellious streak is just as present in black dandyism, though here the stakes are higher. Black dandyism has always been about more than aesthetics. It has been about identity, power, and resistance. In a world where black people have been marginalized, the dandy became a figure who defied the rigid categories of race and class that sought to confine them. The roots of black dandyism lie in the intricate weaving of black culture with European-style fashion, beginning in the post-emancipation period, but coming into full force during the Harlem Renaissance. In the 1920s, Harlem became the epicenter of black intellectual and artistic thought. Figures like Langston Hughes, Josephine Baker, and Zora Neale Hurston were breaking barriers with their literary and artistic contributions. But equally important was the cultural revolution taking place in fashion. The black dandy of the Harlem Renaissance was someone who used dress to assert themselves in a world that often denied them dignity. Just as dandyism had once represented defiance against the traditional aristocracy, it now became a way to reject the limitations placed on black people in America. The sharp suit, the polished shoes, the bow tie. These were not just fashion choices. They were ways of asserting one's right to exist on their own terms. In a racially segregated America, the black dandy's outfit became a form of resistance, an elegant middle finger to a society that sought to define them by race, not character. Fast forward to today, and black dandyism has evolved but remains rooted in those same ideals. The modern black dandy embraces bespoke tailoring, extravagant accessories, and bold color palettes. But the significant is just as potent. Fashion icons like Jadina, whose sharply tailored suits, fedoras, and vibrant patterns offer a modern twist on dandyism, are living testaments to the ongoing power of this style. They are simultaneously creating new norms in fashion while honoring the legacy of those who fought to be seen as more than stereotypes. The upcoming 2025 Met Gala, themed Superfine, Tailoring Black Style, promises to bring black dandyism into the global spotlight once more. This year's theme is a direct acknowledgement of the influence that black culture, particularly black fashion, has had on shaping the broader fashion landscape. Curated by Monica Miller, author of Slaves to Fashion, Black Dandyism and the Styling of Black Diasporic Identity, the exhibition will explore how dandyism in black culture is not just a matter of dress, but an assertion of autonomy, beauty, and power in the face of a world that continues to attempt to restrict black expression. If the early days of black dandyism were rooted in survival, surviving a world that sought to erase or diminish black people, the later evolution has been about flourishing. It's been about taking the heritage of resistance and transforming it into something creative, innovative, and deeply personal. From the Harlem Renaissance to the Black Power movement to today's fashion runways, Black dandyism has adapted with the times, taking on new forms while remaining committed to its core values. Today, black dandyism is alive and well on the fashion runways. Brands like Balmain, under Oliver Rustin, reimagine dandyism with opulent theatrical designs celebrating both black identity and historical reclamation. Tom Brown's precise tailoring and subverted silhouettes challenge traditional norms, while Martine Rose merges street culture with high fashion through oversized, bold pieces that embody contemporary black dandyism. Dior Men, led by Kim Jones, blends luxurious craftsmanship with global influences, making room for a more inclusive narrative, while Seville Rose bespoke tailoring now serves as a platform for black dandies to redefine classical elegance with their own identity. These brands illustrate how black dandyism has seamlessly woven itself into the fabric of high fashion, continuing to empower self-expression and defy sartorial boundaries. The upcoming Met Gala will showcase these shifting dynamics, reflecting the growing importance of black culture in global fashion. Through the Superfine theme, the Met will celebrate the craftsmanship and culture that black dandyism has contributed to high fashion, finally giving it the recognition it deserves. There are some unmistakable elements that define black dandy fashion, but its key characteristic is versatility. Unlike other forms of fashion, black dandyism is fluid. It embraces modern and classic styles, often blending the two to create something uniquely individual. Here's a breakdown of what makes the style so striking. Bespoke tailoring. From hand-stitched suits to perfectly cut trousers, the dandy's whole wardrobe is built on precision and fit. Tailoring is key to this look, and a well-fitted suit is always a statement in itself. Bold colors and patterns. Black dandy fashion isn't afraid to embrace bold prints, whether it's floral patterns, checks or stripes. The color palette often veers away from the somber shades typically associated with formal wear, opting for vibrant hues that stand out. Accessorizing with purpose. A black dandy's accessories, whether it's a pocket square, a fedora, or a pair of statement sunglasses, are never just for show. They're carefully chosen to complement the overall look, adding an additional layer of personality and individuality. Cultural fusion. Modern black dandyism doesn't just echo European sartorial traditions. It incorporates global influence, African textiles, Caribbean flair, and American street style, creating an aesthetic that is both universal and deeply personal. Black dandyism is more than just a style. It's a cultural movement that continues to evolve, adapt, and inspire. From the Harlem Renaissance to the Met Gala's 2025 theme, the impact of black dandyism is felt far beyond fashion. It's a reminder that what we wear is never just about the clothes. It's about identity, power, and the ability to shape the world in our image. When we talk about black dandyism, we are talking about more than just fashion. We are talking about reclaiming space, rewriting narratives, and standing proudly in the face of a history that tried to define us. It is, in essence, an enduring rebellion, one that continues to evolve but always remains rooted in the values of self-expression, pride, and resistance. That was the article, Black Dandyism Explained, From Its 18th Century Roots to Modern-Day Expressions. It was written by Ty Gaskins, and appeared April 29, 2025, in Vogue magazine. My final reading for today's African American Hour is from the website yalebooks.yale.edu. The title of the article is, Who Was Isaac Murphy? One of the Greatest Jockeys in History. This is an excerpt from a book. The book is Isaac Murphy, The Rise and Fall of a Black Jockey by Catherine C. Mooney. This was published February 21st, 2025. The table, covered in white cloths and champagne bottles, stretched through a gap in the trees. Sweating in their suits in the August heat, the guests had traveled by private railway car from New York to a dusty glade at the Jersey Shore for this party. They were the Salvatore Club, and they'd come to celebrate their namesake, the stallion acclaimed as the best horse American racing had ever produced. Salvatore, pronounced the Anaconda Standard, as the greatest horse in history, is exerting a distinct influence upon his time. Surely there would soon be Salvatore hats and neckties, Salvatore cocktails, Salvatore cigars, Salvatore playing cards. There were other stars in thoroughbred racing, then among the most popular sports in the United States. But New York power brokers didn't stage elaborate outdoor banquets for other horses. They celebrated Salvatore because the big striding bright chestnut exerted the centripetal fascination of the greatest athletes. And they respected his owner, James Ben Ali Hagen, the financier who had helped build Anaconda Copper, one of the industry-eating conglomerates that defined the Gilded Age. But they also honored his jockey, the only black man at the table. His name was Isaac Murphy. You may never have heard of him, but everyone you've heard of had. He was born enslaved in 1861. His father died in the Civil War, and his mother supported him by doing domestic work. His family was one of among thousands like it in the market towns of the South in the 1860s. We know his story because he didn't live in just any small town. He lived in Lexington, Kentucky, which was, in his youth, working hard to cement the place it still holds as an international center of thoroughbred racing. Before Murphy was in his teens, he was working with horses. As an adult, he became one of the greatest jockeys in history. When Murphy was still a child, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments to the Constitution of the United States abolished slavery and instituted birthright citizenship, due process, and equal protection of the law, and the right to the franchise for black men. In his lifetime, African Americans worked to give substance to abstractions like freedom and equality in every aspect of their lives. That was a battle through which Isaac Murphy lived and in which some of the people closest to him fought bravely. Murphy's life shows us the daily work of those people, but it also shows us the work of his employers, the men who owned the horses and also often owned the leviathans of American capital, the men who were busy building a society that elevated freedom to make money over equality before the law. Murphy never said much in public. He may have been naturally quiet, or he may have learned in a hard school to keep his thoughts and feelings to himself. And so people attributed to him the thoughts and feelings they wanted him to have. Telling his story is particularly challenging because he left us no personal papers and only a few interviews with reporters who may or may not have faithfully transcribed what he said. In black communities and newspapers, celebrations of Murphy's success joined tales of other leaders in politics and the professions. In racing results and interviews, in jockey's room photographs matter-of-factly posed alongside white colleagues, Murphy seemed to prove that a truly free and equal society was possible. He was the example that proved the rule, the sign to point the way. But the very possibility that men like Murphy embodied sparked visceral rejection in many white Americans, who refused to live in a society where a black man could be a successful, stylish hero. The political and legal challenges that made Murphy's career possible enraged people who, throughout his lifetime, violently sought to reverse those changes. Meanwhile, courts and legislatures nibbled away at the new amendments to the Constitution so that their guarantees could be drained of meaning. And white Americans told their own stories to make what they were doing seem right and inevitable. They insisted that blackness was a condition that could be described and measured, and that determined a person's physical and mental capacities. These kinds of ideas about race often flourished in places assumed to be outside politics, like entertainment and sports, and they underpinned an understanding of the world in which black people had no right to political citizenship because they had very little right to human dignity. Successful black people who supposedly conformed to racial hierarchy without questioning it were praised for doing so. They were the exceptions that proved the rule, and Isaac Murphy was one of the prime examples of those people. He was one of the subjects on which Americans practiced the narratives that would power the racial hierarchies that survived and reshaped themselves after slavery. The stories surrounding his life are texts that illustrate how racism has evolved and how it sorts human beings and assigns them value, how it can flex and cling and find ways to turn its inconsistencies and hypocrisies into vindications and victories. To tell his story is also to tell two of the great stories of 19th century America. The debates over what a world without slavery, a multiracial democracy might look like, and the battles over who was to hold political power in an economy that increasingly resembled the corporate, wealth-polarized one we know today. And it is to recognize how similar the stories about Murphy are to those that have sprung up around generations of black athletes over decades of civil rights struggles. His story should remind us of the stories of Joe Louis, of Jackie Robinson, of John Carlos and Tommy Smith, of Michael Jordan, of Serena Williams, of the Atlanta Dream, of Colin Kaepernick. It is on the bodies of black athletes that we have written national accounts of citizenship and rights, of deserving and belonging. In the last scene he wrote of his final unfinished novel, Ralph Ellison envisioned one of his white main characters looking at a series of lithographs and suddenly seeing American history from a new perspective. He examines images of an enslaved mother, of John Brown, of Jack Johnson, and of Isaac Murphy. Maybe he thinks if he looks at these pictures he can grasp the complex role played in our fractured democracy by the sports and the arts. Maybe he'll glimpse how much has been forgotten or erased, how much could have been and could still be different. Maybe he can understand something about our fractured democracy itself. That was an excerpt from the book, Isaac Murphy, The Rise and Fall of a Black Jockey, written by Catherine C. Mooney and published by Yale University Press. The title of the article is, Who Was Isaac Murphy? One of the Greatest Jockeys in History. Published February 21, 2025 at the website yalebooks.yale.edu. This article also has information about the author, and it says Catherine C. Mooney is James P. Jones Professor of History at Florida State University. She is also the author of Racehorse Men, How Slavery and Freedom Were Made at the Racetrack. She lives in Tallahassee, Florida. That's all the time we have this week. If you would like to listen to this program again or past editions of the African American Hour, you can find them wherever you get your podcasts or at the Audio Reader website at reader.ku.edu. I'm Byron Buckner, and thank you for listening to the African American Hour.